I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. For nearly 40 years, Frank Weevil and his wife Denise have led the struggle for medical freedom in America and throughout the world. Frank was a successful Columbia Records recording artist, engineer, and producer. In July 1985, he happened to be in Freeport, Bahamas, accompanying his sick father-in-law when the Bahamian government, at the instigation of the United States National Cancer Institute, shut down the Lawrence Burton IAT Cancer Clinic. The IAT patients organized and asked Frank to become first president of their association. Frank and Denise led them in a march on Washington and drafted the petition for an evaluation of innovative therapies signed by 43 congressmen. Frank was the original requester of their Office of Technology Assessment, OTA, study entitled Alternative Cancer Therapies, and testified at the congressional hearing. Frank led site visits to clinics being researched by OTA, and the IAT clinic was reopened. In 1986, Frank and his wife Denise founded People Against Cancer and organized the International Coalition for the Evaluation of Alternative Cancer Therapies. It was largely through such efforts, including bitter struggles over 3 years, that the OTA report was rewritten and made into a useful document for Congress and the public. In conversations with thousands of people with cancer, health advocates, as well as over 50 members of Congress, guest appearances on Design for Living, Natural Living for the People, and other radio programs, prominently featured interviews in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Des Moines Register, Scientific America, Science, East West, and so forth, and publications in the Journal of the American Medical Association and the International Association of Cancer Victims and Friends Journal, Frank tirelessly fought for the fair testing of innovative, non-toxic cancer therapies. In 1993, Frank was a founding member of the Office of Alternative Medicine, OAM, in the National Institute of Health. In 1994, Frank was chosen to be the chairman of the Pharmacological and Biological Treatments Committee and chosen to serve a 4-year term on the National Advisory Board of the Office of Alternative Medicine. Scientific America wrote, "The establishment of the Office of Alternative Medicine, OAM, constitutes a victory for Frank Weevil." Through People Against Cancer, Frank has created and administered the Alternative Therapy Research Program, a program to evaluate treatment options for people with cancer and physicians. Frank has also created and organized the International Physicians Network to provide innovative treatment options for people with cancer. In 1996, Frank launched the Alternative Therapy Evaluation Program to conduct scientific evaluations, both retrospective and prospective, of innovative treatments for cancer worldwide. Frank has been called the most powerful independent voice in the field of cancer. He is the editor of the critically acclaimed newsletter, Options, New Direction in the War on Cancer, the most revolutionary document published in the field of cancer, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Options remain the only independent newsletter in the field, published without outside influence or advertisements. Frank remains People Against Cancer's founding executive and runs the grassroots organization from his base in Otoe, Iowa, population 650, where he lives with his wife, Denise, and their daughters, Megan and Allison. More information is available at www.peopleagainstcancer.org. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Frank, and I look forward to hearing about your many years working for medical freedom in America and throughout the world. Now, first, how did you get started in this work?
Carl, I was became involved. I was a Columbia Records recording artist, and I was ready to go out on tour with U2 when my father-in-law was diagnosed with cancer. And mm-hmm. we took him to the Mayo Clinic, and I asked a lot of pertinent questions about what kinds of treatment he should get. And I got a lot of answers that puzzled me, and I went back and did some research, and we went back to the Mayo and asked them very specific questions. And they said, well, we should have chemotherapy after the surgery is done. And I said, well, we've looked at all of your reviews of chemotherapy in the New England Journal and the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it appears, statistically speaking, that none of these treatments actually improve survival or quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at me quite surprised that a mere mortal had looked at his studies in New England Journal of Medicine, the peer-reviewed medical literature, if you will. He looked at his colleague, Cregan, and he looked back, this was Dr. Charles Mortel, and he said to me, well, that's true, but we give it to the patients so they don't give up hope and so they don't fall into the hands of the quacks.
Hmm.
And I said, well, it's hard for me to tell who the quack is in that scenario. Well, he was insulted by a mere mortal who had the audacity to read his studies and mm-hmm. then quote back to him. He stomped the earth with his, turned on his heel, and out the door he went, followed by eight little minions who hung on his every word. He'd been insulted by someone who had the audacity to read his words
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
to understand them. I was put off by a man who was willing to treat my father-in-law with a treatment that he knew to be ineffective and he knew to have no evidence of improved survival or quality of life. So this was the start of my mission to find out and to get to the bottom of this. So I went looking to see if I could find an organization that would evaluate a patient and patient records where they were and tell the patient what their options were without bias.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're aware, very credible men and women of science have discussed bias in medicine. And
mm-hmm.
bias in medicine has been one of the biggest problems that we have in terms of assessing what is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, because we all bring our biases. All we can hope to be is to be fair. But these biases are so real and so profound in clinical trials that the first thing I did was I went to my congressman, Senator Charles Grassley, and I went to my congressman, Berkeley Bedell, and we asked if we could do a study of the Office of Technology Assessment, an independent arm of Congress at the time who were doing assessments of technological questions. So they would be unbiased people doing an unbiased study on a very highly controversial area. So
mm-hmm.
the first question I asked was about assessing medical technologies, and they had published a study by that name, Assessing Medical Technologies. And the question was, how much of American medicine was proven, because they were saying that we have proven medicine and unproven medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Unproven medicine is what we now think of as alternative medicine or traditional medicine or holistic medicine. That was the charge.
Mm-hmm.
That conventional medicine was proven and unconventional medicine was unproven. Well, the study showed that only 15% of all medicine currently in practice has been shown safe or effective by clinical trial. Conventional
mm-hmm.
medicine.
Mm-hmm.
85% had never been shown safe or effective. 85% of American medicine fit our Senate's definition of the word quackery,
mm-hmm.
which is unproven medicine promoted for a profit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they hated my guts from right out of the box, okay? They hated that I asked the question. They hated that we got the answer. They hated that we used the data. So I said, so, in the Office of Alternative Medicine that I hope to put together, Tom Harkin was talking about it, Berkeley Bedell was talking about it, I was talking about it, they asked me to chair the Pharmacological and Biological Treatments Committee, and we looked very carefully at cancer,
mm-hmm.
and we looked at the figures about cancer treatment,
mm-hmm.
and we found that chemotherapy, the contribution of chemotherapy to five-year survival was zip.
Right, right.
Literally 2.3%.
Mm-hmm.
2.1%, I'm sorry. So 2.1%, 97.9% of people who received chemotherapy did not have improved survival or quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So how was I going to go somewhere and get this kind of information when the information didn't even exist before we put the Office of Alternative Medicine together? Now, interestingly, when we went to NIH, they were very reluctant to put in place an office which mm-hmm. would involve alternative anything. So they called it. They came back to us and they said, well, we've set up an office and we're going to call it the Office of Unconventional Medical Practices. And I said, no, you're not. And they said, I beg your pardon. I said, no, you might as well call it the Committee on Quackery.
Mm-hmm.
Because the name smears the subject that we're going to be covering. So what do people call it? Let's get real here. What do the people call it? And I said, I've got data that will show that the people call it alternative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Alternative medicine is using vitamins, minerals, herbs, natural medicine. So I said the office should be called the Office of Alternative Medicine. So OAM it became.
Mm-hmm.
And OAM started out to study the things that I had originally hoped that there would be an organization to study, which was, what's the real story? Okay,
mm-hmm.
What is the real truth? Let's get to the bottom line and strip away the biases and strip away the hopes and the dreams and the promises and everything about the war on cancer. And let's look at the war on cancer, number one. Let's look at the war on heart disease, number two. And let's look at the war on HIV. Number one, cancer and heart disease are one or two, depending on which data you use or which statistics you use, in terms of the two killer diseases that result in premature death in America. And HIV had never been cured.
Mm-hmm.
Period. End of story. We had some antivirals at the time, but there hadn't been a single patient who'd ever been cured of HIV. So I figured this was a pretty good place to start. Well, they came back quite upset that I thought that this was a pretty good place we should start. And they said, well, we were thinking about chiropractic and massage therapy and things like this. And I said, so how many deaths resulted from a lack of massage therapy last year?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we're looking at important public health issues, issues that define our world. When my grandfather was born in 1900, cancer was 1 in 100 Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, cancer eclipsed 1 in 2 Americans.
Right, right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So how are we doing and how goes the war on cancer? That's what I want to know. And you convince me that that shouldn't be the number one thing that we study. Okay? And they went back and they looked at it and they looked at me and they looked at everything and they thought, boy, how do we get rid of this guy? You know, because I was clearly a thorn in their side. But
mm-hmm.
I met the then director of the NIH,
mm-hmm.
the most powerful man in the whole government involving the National Institutes of Health. His name was Jay Moskowitz. And Jay and I got along very well. Jay and I were, he was a PhD. So I said, well, you know, you're not an MD. And, you know, I said, I'm not an MD either. And I hope you won't hold that against me. And I said, I won't hold it against you that you aren't an MD. And we got along. Problem is this, that when we're trained to use chemotherapy, we will defend it with all our might. We will make defensive comments and suggestions and do outrageous things without really looking carefully at what we're doing. People want two things when they're treated for cancer. They want to live longer and they want to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Why else would you go to a doctor unless you would live longer or feel better as a result? That's what you hope. That's
mm-hmm.
what everyone hopes
mm-hmm.
when they go to a physician or go into the hospital or go for treatment of any kind. So these are the bottom lines. So I met with Frank Young, then director of the Food and Drug Administration, and I remember The first thing I did was in my committee, I decided that we would call Frank Young and have him testify in front of our committee so we could put it all on the official record.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the director then of the OAM totally flipped out. He was totally flipped out. He said, "You can't do this." I said, "Of course I can." I said, "Either that or we'll pull him in front of a congressional hearing and Harkin will grill him. It doesn't make any difference. I'd just like to do it here where we're all amongst friends, where we can put it on the record." Well, he just figured, "I'll never work in this field again."
Mm-hmm.
If he's going to do this, okay? This was not customary. It was not customary to ask public health officials direct questions.
Mm-hmm.
And as any good prosecutor, you have to know the answer to the question before you ask it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say, "How goes the war on cancer?" Okay, so Frank Young chimes in and he says, "Well, we've decided that we're going to use different endpoints for deciding on the approval of new medicines because the progress against cancer has been incremental at best." Okay, well, that's true. We all knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice that he said it because he admitted it. And then we began to ask him questions about what it was that they were doing. And he said, "Well, we're now approving drugs based on response." And I said, "So," I listened to his explanation and I listened to how he had set out these drugs were being approved because of the response rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked a simple question: does response have anything to do with survival?
Good question.
And there was a long, pregnant pause. And here's the problem. It doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We now know that the size of a tumor has virtually no relationship whatsoever to the length of the life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I can take a whole host of chemotherapy-type treatments, and I can treat your cancer. And I can make those tumors smaller. Unfortunately, often the patient dies in the process. Okay? So what is the endpoint? What is the result? Do we want to take a surrogate endpoint like response that has nothing to do with survival? Or do we want to do what people want? People want to live longer. People want to feel better. So I decided that it would be a good thing to look at the whole range of issues with cancer. Do these drugs that we're looking at actually improve survival? And the answer that we got was no. And I went and looked at what was the questions of quality of life and do the patients feel better. The answer was chemotherapy was one of the worst kinds of treatment in terms of quality of life. People lost their hair. People lost massive amounts of weight, in some cases 20 or 30% of their body weight. People couldn't eat. They were nauseous. They were vomiting. They were lost red blood cell count. They were almost debilitated by the treatment. Sometimes these treatments were worse than the disease itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at these things carefully and we decided that we should do, I set up a triage. Okay. In war, we have to triage. When you have a big, massive accident, you have to triage in order to use the resources. So I said, okay, I would like to set something up to do the studies of this. I would like to go and take the existing alternative medicines that are in practice. Okay. I suggested people like Ludwig. She was alive
mm-hmm.
at the
mm-hmm.
in Germany. And I suggested Brzezinski, who
mm-hmm.
was in Houston, Texas, Burton, who was in Freeport, Bahamas, Gerson, who was in Tijuana, Mexico, previously in New York, and picked out the top five in terms of these people clearly have evidence in fighting cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
There is evidence. Most of those that I just named off had between 5 and 10,000 patients who they've been treated. So it's a pretty large sample size. A pretty good group that we could look at and determine whether or not what they were doing was having a beneficial effect, and if so, what kind of a beneficial effect, and if there was side effects, and what kind of side effects, and bottom line, were people living longer or were people feeling better? So we chose to go to visit these hospitals, these
mm-hmm.
clinics, and talk to these doctors. And we took a team from NIH down to visit Dr. Lawrence Burton. in the Bahamas. He had, Burton was a researcher from the conventional medical world who had been at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York. While he was there, he discovered that there were certain immune proteins. Let's say he would take your blood. And he would look at your blood, and he would determine if it had sufficient levels of certain immune proteins that he felt were valuable in fighting illness, your disease, if you came to him with a disease. He would measure these, and then he determined that there were certain groups of immune proteins that continued to be deficient in people who had cancer. The ones that were most important, he isolated, then extracted from the blood of healthy patients, and he developed the procedure for extraction, and then gave them back to people with cancer, bringing them into what he called immune competence.
Mm-hmm.
Much like a diabetic would augment their supply of insulin, he was augmenting their supply of immune protein. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, the patients began to fight their cancer. He said this is probably not only because of the deficiencies in this orchestral immune system. The immune system is like an orchestra. And if you hear the tuba playing, it doesn't sound like much music. It's just do-ba-do-ba-do. And if you hear just a violin playing, it doesn't sound like an orchestra. It sounds like a violin. And you put them all together, and it's a wonderful orchestra. And it's a whole functioning unit. Well, the immune system's a lot like an orchestra. There are many different kinds of cells, and different kinds of reactions have to occur. First thing the immune system has to do is to identify cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this sounds simple. Identify the cancer. Well, it isn't so simple. Why is that? Because cancer is self. It's us.
Mm-hmm.
It's our cells, which are being programmed to grow endlessly out of control, to not die properly. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They don't live and die normally, like all the rest of the cells in our body. They grow endlessly out of control. They outrun healthy tissue. So we looked at that very carefully. We said, okay, patrol. The immune system has to patrol. It has to identify. It has to go through the body. It has to patrol. It has to identify. Then it has to isolate these cells, which are different, and has to eliminate them.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds simple. 1, 2, 3, 4. Patrol, identify, isolate, eliminate. Problem is, there's lots of things that can go wrong in the patrol. There's lots of things that can go wrong in the identify. There's lots of things that can go wrong in the isolate and in the eliminate phase. So we have to go back and make sure all those things are working. Okay, all those cells and all those orchestral things, the violins have to be there, the cellos have to be there, the tubas have to be there, the flutes have to be there. All of these things have to be working for this cascade and this orchestral response to work properly. So Burton's idea was, okay, let's look at the things which are deficient, the main things which are deficient, and see if we can't resupply them in the already realized form. Okay, you're not making new proteins, you're taking them from the blood of a healthy person and putting them in the blood of a person who has cancer, and they're becoming immune competent. So Burton had demonstrated this over and over and repeated it. At one point, he gave a seminar and invited the press because he said, I'm getting nowhere. They're going to kick me out of St. Vincent's because they said, I'm treating their patients. I said, who told you that? He said, the tumor board. And he said, they're your patients to the tumor board? Well, by this time, Burton had kind of gotten sideways with them because they were treating with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of patients, before they did those treatments, thought it would be a good idea just to take some shots and see if they could get their cancer to
mm-hmm.
go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bert started treating patients. He said, I must admit that most of the patients that I treated at first were aggressively treated with conventional therapy before they came to me. But then they started to find out that this was something different. And they called me up in front of the tumor board, said I was treating their patients, and they could no longer do that. And he said, well, I'm the senior associate in oncology. I think I can do that, and I think that that's what I'll continue to do. Well, they all got together and threw him out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he gave this conference, and the headline from the press, he gave a demonstration. He invited everyone. He invited everyone in the medical establishment. Everyone, some of the people came. He injected mice with the serum that he had made, and the tumors began to soften and disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Right there,
mm-hmm.
right then and there. And the animals didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
So chemotherapy would have killed the animals while it was killing the tumor.
Right.
Because that much chemotherapy is going to kill the tumor, but it's going to kill the animal. Okay. That's the problem with chemotherapy, and that's the ratio of healthy to diseased cells. The holy grail, Carl, of cancer is to kill only the cancer cell and spare the healthy cell. That's the holy grail. That's what we're looking for. Unfortunately, many of these chemotherapy agents kill an equal number of healthy cells as they do the cancer cells. Hence, the treatment was a tremendous success. Unfortunately, the patient died. It's absurd. I mean, who thinks that it would be a tremendous success if the tumor went away, if the patient died? So we have to be very clear with people about what it is that we're doing. And I said, we have to understand, what is Burton doing here? Is he helping one of 1,000? Is he helping one of 100? Is he helping one of 10? Is he helping one of 2? We really don't know. So I said, the first thing we want to do is set up this triage system. We want to go to the clinics like Burton. We went to the clinic and Burton agreed to cooperate with the researchers and we pulled files. Okay. We had a criteria and you had to have original pathology, film scans, bloods, and that's the diagnosis of cancer. You had to have how much cancer, where it was, blood tests, and then the treatment started. And then the period of time the treatment took place and what was the result of that treatment, film scans, bloods, a determination if the treatment was successful, if the treatment caused the tumor to regress and get smaller, if it caused the tumor to stabilize, if it caused the tumor to disappear, if it caused 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year, 6 year, 7 year, 8 year, 9 year, 10 year survival. Okay, survival being the obvious endpoint that we were after. So we assembled a group of, and like any clinic and like any place, you know, when the patients are instructed to send back their films from their doctors in the United States, this is when Burton was in Freeport, Bahamas. Sometimes they would send them back, and sometimes they would tell their doctor to send them back, and sometimes the doctor would, and sometimes the doctor wouldn't. And so we found that there were many cases where current exams or current follow-ups were not in the file. So we set those aside and just took the ones where there was original pathology, film scans, bloods, treatment by Dr. Burton, and then film scans, bloods, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 years, etc. Okay? And then we took that group and we gave them to University of Pennsylvania. There were 79 of them that we picked out with a variety of different kinds of cancer. And the University of Pennsylvania applied to the NIH to get money to do a comparative analysis. They would compare these patients that Burton had treated to the patients who were treated conventionally at the University of Pennsylvania. And lo and behold, months went by, nothing was published. And so I called the researcher and asked them what the results of the research were. Well, we're still evaluating the data. And I said, how long will you be? And they said, well, it could be weeks, it could be months, it may even be years. So I said, okay, I want the data. They said, well, we're not going to give you the data until we've made our conclusions. I said, yes, you're going to look at the contract, which says that you agree to give us the data. So they gave us the data. We had cooperated with them to evaluate this. We wanted the data.
Right.
You know, that they were, and so the data showed that the patients who were treated by IAT, immuno-augmentative therapy by Dr. Lawrence Burton, were alive approximately twice as long as those patients treated with matched controls. That's the people who compared to Burton's treatment at the University of Pennsylvania. I said, oh, now I know why they won't publish it. So I called the researcher and she said, we're under tremendous pressure not to publish it. I said, why would that be? Because the patients are alive twice as long. Did you realize that the majority of those patients are still alive? That survival may not be twice. It may be three times. It may be even longer than that. So I was introduced, baptized, if you will, by fire. And I learned that there was publishing bias. Okay, which is, if I don't like the results, I don't publish. I do the study. It doesn't come out like I want. I just don't publish the study. So what it does is it skews the data. If I have 10 studies, If I have study number one, bad results. I manipulate the data. Study number two, a little bit better results. I manipulate the data, questions. Always data depends on the questions that you ask. What are the questions can determine what answers you get.
Mm-hmm.
And so by biasing the questions, you can then determine what it is you can run and publish with. If you want a positive study, you can manipulate the results before you even get the results by the questions. So there's many kinds of biases that come into play. First bias is the proponent involved in the study design. Okay, the study design itself. How was the study designed? And we learned all about this and determined that very often you don't get the results that you hope you will get. So you just don't publish it. You go on and you change the criteria by which you collect data until you get the results that you want. And maybe mm-hmm. those results won't even be actual, real, overall survival advantage. Maybe they'll just be relative survival advantage. If you find a chemotherapy that has a study that shows that the patients live one day longer, then you have a new study that says the patients live 2 days longer and that 100% survival advantage. How's that?
Mm-hmm.
It's relative survival advantage. Relative to what? 1 day. So you live 2 days longer instead of 1 day. That's 100% survival advantage. So they begin to publish relative survival, not actual survival.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at all of the data about conventional medicine. We were convinced that what we needed to do was take this small group and call it a pilot study. Okay, this was a pilot study, and have it researched and have it evaluated by a group of researchers from, throughout the country. And then those which passed muster, those which we believed had sufficient data in this small pilot trial, would be put on to the next level, where mm-hmm. we designed a randomized trial. Okay, with placebo controls and what you know and I mm-hmm. know and we all know to be the gold standard. Okay, larger the group, and these patients would be self-selected.
Frank, we're going to have to kind of finish up this part because we only have about 20 minutes more to talk about people against cancer and your treatment
yes.
programs and all. So we need to kind of finish up this part.
Okay. Okay, so I'll wrap it up. So at the Office of Alternative Medicine, they currently are not studying cancer. They're currently not studying heart disease. They're currently not studying HIV. They're not studying which treatments might help people to live longer or feel better, and they aren't looking at what treatments do not. That's the sadness about the OAM. I think it opened a lot of doors. I think it made a lot of difference in the future mm-hmm. of medicine by simply opening the doors to the public health service and people looking at alternative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so next area.
Can you tell us about People Against Cancer?
Yeah. People Against Cancer, Carl, is a nonprofit public interest group that I founded when I looked for whether or not there was an organization that was going to be able to evaluate the best treatment options for people who had cancer. So if you have cancer, most people go to a major medical center, a major cancer center. There are comprehensive cancer centers from the National Cancer Institute throughout the country. And people go there and they get conventional medicine for their cancer. They get 1, surgery, 2, chemotherapy, 3, radiotherapy, sometimes hormonal therapy and new drugs, and very, very seldom in the last 30 or 40 years were there any innovative things used outside of that small group of treatments. So we wanted to see, after looking at all of these organizations and clinics in the Office of Alternative Medicine, we wanted to see if there were people who were living longer and people who would be willing to put their name on the line. And we determined that maybe this would be a good way to see what the best treatments for the most common kinds of cancer were. And we visited all of the clinics in the United States and throughout the world. And we went to as far as Russia. We went to Vienna. We went throughout Germany. We went to England, Ireland, throughout Europe, really. We went to Africa. And we evaluated what people were doing that was outside of the box and, mm-hmm. and the new thing that they were doing. And then we determined what we felt was really causing the patients to live longer and feel better, looked at the data, evaluated the data, and determined what we felt could be useful. Then we enlisted some of the doctors and researchers who were doing those things to evaluate patient records and determine whether or not they felt that particular treatment was warranted, and found that patients had more choices. They had more choices about what they might do. One in particular, when a patient has conventional treatment, often they want to take vitamins, minerals, or nutrients together with that conventional treatment. So we were very curious about whether or not what the oncologists were saying was correct or not, and that was that they shouldn't take any of these, because megadoses of vitamins obviously could interfere with conventional chemotherapy. Well, my question was, do they actually? My question was, do we know if they actually do? So Dr. Charles Simon, who treated Reagan when he was in the White House, came to our rescue because he felt that his oncologist colleagues were making these statements without any basis, and that they were based on a comment that it could interfere. Mm-hmm. So he looked and found that actually vitamins, minerals, and nutrients in the forms provided as antioxidants, one, improved the tumor kill.
Mm-hmm.
It actually made the medicine, conventional medicine, work better. Two, it caused a reduction of side effects by protecting healthy cells and organs and systems of the body. And lastly, perhaps most importantly, is that they improve survival. So he demonstrated to us that conventional medicine ignores the concepts of diet, nutrition, supplementation, detoxification, and natural anti-cancer agents that might even make the chemotherapy work better because they didn't fit into the drug model. So we looked at a bunch of things, like what were the first things? Obviously vitamin C, and I called Dr. Pauling when he was alive, and he joined with us together to describe to us how the Mayo Clinic had falsified the collaborative studies. That first they asked him to collaborate, he gave them the protocol of how to study vitamin C, and then they violated it and did it differently. The first patients that Pauling treated were treated with 10 grams IV of vitamin C, Cameron's patient treated with 10 grams IV, which is very different than 10 grams orally.
Right.
Compliance is an issue. You know, if a person's got a shot, you know if they got the medicine with IV. If you don't, you don't know whether they took the number of pills they said they were going to take or they were supposed to take. And you don't know if the controls took vitamin C anyway. So the people who weren't supposed to be taking vitamin C that you were going to compare the vitamin C-treated patients with, you don't know if they were actually taking vitamin C because they knew they were in a vitamin C trial. So the bottom line was this, that vitamin C seemed to improve survival and improve tumor kill, and was in and of itself a pro-oxidant, not an antioxidant at low doses, as you get used to hearing about. You know, the antioxidant effects of vitamin C are real. But when they're used in mega doses of 20 grams, 50 grams, 100 grams, etc., then they become pro-oxidants, a non-toxic chemotherapy that kills cancer cells while it spares healthy cells. We thought this is very exciting. And so this is one aspect. High dose vitamin C is the concept originally put forward by Pauling, and of course he met with great difficulty, and he said, well, they're not willing to do the science. I mean, the science says that it does take twice the dose of vitamin C to achieve it does take 10 times the dose of vitamin C to achieve twice the blood level. So when you're taking it orally, you have to take 10 times as much to double the blood levels. And this was something that conventional medicine couldn't fathom, that you would have to give this much of it to have this effect. So we looked at that. We looked at the doctors who were producing this. We looked at the doctors like Burton and Brzezinski and Gerson. And we began to develop this program where we could help people to get this information about what might help them live longer and what might help them feel better. And we looked at the conventional medicine, and for a long period of time, I was perplexed because the conventional medicine had basically put immunology out, because they thought that if your body would fight off cold, it's bacterial. The body would fight off a virus, rhinoviruses, and if a body would fight off routine germs that you're exposed to on a regular basis, then the immune system was functioning. So the immune system, thereby, didn't have anything to do with cancer. What they didn't realize was virus is very different than a cancer cell. A virus looks obviously different than our own cells. A bacterial illness looks very different than our own cells. So we looked at immunology, and we often, I traveled to Russia to visit Valentin Gavalo, who was a Russian immunologist who believed that substances from the human placenta would demask or unmask these tumor cells, and the body's immune system would then identify them and eliminate them. He called it a cloaking device, like in Star Trek. The ships would be escape detection because they had some mechanism to cloak them from the radar or cloak them from whatever device you used to find out what they were. So recognition factor was something that we were lacking. And there was these things were found in various forms. Gavalo felt that what this did was unmask the tumor, allowing the immune system to recognize, then attack the tumor. Well, when we were there and he gave patients treatment, they would describe tactile sensations at the site of the tumor, little pinpricks, mm-hmm. like your foot is falling asleep, but like, you know, tactile sensations right at the tumor. These would go on for periods of time as the tumor would be destroyed, and then they would stop when the tumor was gone. And it was interesting because there was this cause effect. You would give them this placental extract, which was gleaned from the placenta after live, healthy human birth, and he was giving this in an injection and unmasking the tumor. He wrote about it in his book, The Immunology of Pregnancy and Cancer. And I gave the book to a researcher at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and he said, if what Gavalo says is true, this may be one of the discoveries of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And we believed it to be true, and we saw the effects of what he was doing. And this was very, very similar to what Burton was doing, and I call it the birth of immunology in cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these were the innovators, perhaps 50 or 60 years ahead of their colleagues,
mm-hmm.
and completely outside of the box. Well, I talked about the immune system a lot at NIH, and I talked a lot about the immune system generally, supported what Dr. Burton was doing, supported what Dr. Gavalo was doing, was very fascinated by the idea that you, Carl, or I, Frank, mm-hmm. could have in my own body, could possess the ability to fight off this cancer,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that it was within us already, and it was a part of the human body, and it was only a mistake or a misfire that would not identify, not patrol, not isolate, not eliminate these cancer cells before they became tumors. So we set out to put together a program. So when I was looking at this for my father-in-law, all I wanted was to call someone who knew more than I did about this and who had been around the world to study these things and who understood intuitively what seemed to work and what didn't work and what seemed to be the direction of the future of cancer research and not just the past, while not ignoring the benefits that we had in the world of cancer.
So mm-hmm.
very great successes have been achieved in conventional cancer therapy, and some people have had striking survival advantages and lived much, much longer as a result. There are very rare cancers, the childhood leukemias, the rhabdomyosarcomas, the rare kinds of cancer that have been successfully treated, the germ cell or seminomas. Lance Armstrong had a seminoma. Spectacular results. Cleared his entire body of cancer with this massive chemotherapy regimen. It is a success. It
mm-hmm.
did work. The question is, does this kind of approach work on 98% of the cancer? And it doesn't seem to.
Mm-hmm.
So we suggest that patients look.
My interview with Frank Weevil ended abruptly because of equipment failure. We had hoped to get together again to complete the interview, but this did not work out because of our schedules. I'm sorry for not having a complete interview. Because we have some time left today, I would like to talk with you about my new Cancer Foundation and an opportunity that I think will be of interest to you. My new Cancer Foundation can be found at holisticcancerfoundation.com. On the site, you will see first a video of the foundation. You will also see the goals, which are education, research, and patient care. I have an impressive board and advisory board for this foundation, and you can look at these on the site. I have worked for over a year getting content on the site, including interviews with cancer patients and doctors, cancer research, cancer treatment, and what is different on my site is research on mental, spiritual interventions and interviews with experts for interviews like affirmations, visualization, prayer, meditation, gratitude, forgiveness, and many others. These are included because I believe that disease results from multiple factors, and consequently, a holistic approach is necessary for recovering from cancer. To me, prayer, faith, optimism, and others are as important in treatment as medication, supplements, diet, and other interventions. I have experience to support this belief. Having used a holistic approach since 1970, when I volunteered as a camp nurse for the Edgar Cayce organization, it was natural to use this approach when I was diagnosed with lung cancer in 1974. Curing this disease with all natural holistic interventions, I continued using the approach in my personal life and with clients, and am now considered a pioneer in holistic health. I have worked for the past 5 to 6 months on the website section on prevention of cancer. This finished in a download gift of this material, around 50 pages, available for those who donate $12 or more to the foundation and receive a tax deduction receipt plus this gift. The booklet available as a download, titled Reduce Your Cancer Risk, A Holistic Approach. It will include the following. First, as a longtime educator, I like to start my writing with a theoretical framework in which to place the content. So there is first a theoretical framework based upon public health concepts. This framework will basically look at, first, ways to reduce the risk of known environmental carcinogens, and second, ways to strengthen the host against environmental and other carcinogens. Content on reducing the effect of known environmental carcinogens include electromagnetic waves, toxic chemicals such as BPA, formaldehyde, toxic metals such as aluminum and mercury, and last, ultraviolet waves. For all areas, there will be research related to the carcinogen, what you can do to reduce the risk, and an interview with an expert for many of these. The second part looks at ways to strengthen the host or you against carcinogens. It includes areas such as physical activities, nutrition including genetically modified organisms, organic food, etc., fluids, water and milk, supplements, vitamins, minerals, immune builders, sleep, smoking cessation, music, and then it moves into mental, spiritual interventions that includes affirmations, compassion, faith, forgiveness, gratitude, meditation, optimism, prayer, relaxation exercises, serving or helping others, social support, stress reduction, and visualization. Again, for each of these, there is research, what to do to strengthen yourself against cancer, and interviews with experts for many of these. You will hear interviews with 30 cancer or related experts on mental, spiritual interventions, such as forgiveness, gratitude, faith, and compassion. You'll hear about omega-3s, genetically modified organisms, genetically modified food, plant-based and other nutritional diets, smoking cessation, chemical and mental carcinogens, immune builders, music, and much, much more. So I hope this will be helpful to you and will help in preventing cancer in the future. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey, on my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.